Good morning. This is James Stevenson with the Morning World News Roundup, and today we expect to hear from NBC observers in London, Washington, and Tokyo. But first, here are the day's major news headlines. The big three foreign ministers are scheduled to get down to business today in their first formal meeting of their Moscow conference. Complete secrecy enshrouds the discussion, but it is reported that an atmosphere of cordiality gives hope that this time the meeting of foreign ministers will bring Russia, Britain, and the United States into closer agreement on world peace. In Japan, far-reaching repercussions are expected to follow the suicide of Prince Konoye, ex-premier who swallowed poison rather than face trial as a war criminal. New trouble is brewing in Iran today, following establishment of a so-called autonomous government in Azerbaijan province. Unconfirmed reports say that the Iranian premier has resigned. In China, both central government and communist leaders are awaiting arrival of General Marshall for clarification of United States policy as announced by President Truman. On the home front, labor and industry today are turning attention to Detroit, where the Auto Workers Union opens wage discussions with the new Kaiser-Frazier Corporation while continuing negotiations with the Ford Motor Company and the strike-bound General Motors Corporation. Those are today's major news headlines. In a moment, I'll call in NBC observers for their first-hand accounts.
Sometimes the simple facts are far more striking than any dramatic appeal. So here are the simple facts. Between Pearl Harbor and VJ Day, more Americans were killed in accidents than in the war itself. For each serviceman injured in battle, 50 civilians were the victims of accidents. These grim facts are all the more tragic because this crippling and loss of life on the accident front is so unnecessary, so useless. Wartime conditions have made many activities more dangerous, but the fact remains that the most important single cause of accidents is carelessness. So be careful, neighbor, at home, at work, and in traffic. The war is over. Let's bring that accident rate down, too. And again, here is James Stevenson.
While the big three foreign ministers meet in Moscow in a history-making conference, Britain today is all agog because Big Herman is now a dud. For a first-hand report, we switch to NBC in London.
This is Ed Hawker in London. It's all clear in the South Croydon section of London. The inhabitants have gone home. The sighs of relief are almost audible miles away. At 4 o'clock this morning, British time, with the local people all sleeping a safe distance away, Herman, the 2-ton German bomb, was rendered harmless, or almost harmless. The bomb had been steamed, given a Turkish bath, and there was no longer any possibility of the 3,000 pounds of TNT exploding and blowing everything to smithereens. There then remained only the job of cutting off the two fuses at the end of the bomb, a ticklish job in itself, since each one of those fuses contained 2 pounds of TNT. But if these were to explode, in the words of Lieutenant Frake, who's in charge of the operation, well, he added cheerfully, there would be no danger except to those of us working on Herman. Now those two fuses have been removed. A secret machine was used. Herman is heading for the dump heap. The Royal Engineers, who have been working 200 days on Herman, get a much-needed rest. South Croydon has lost a neighbor. It's been with the people since January 11th, 1941, and needless to say, the departure of Herman was not accompanied by tears. In Moscow today, the three foreign ministers, Mr. Burns, Mr. Bevan, and Mr. Molotov, sit down for their first concrete discussion. Last night's session was simply of a preparatory nature. Mr. Burns and Mr. Bevan both were early risers. Both went into a huddle with their own experts, including the experts on Middle Eastern affairs. Both men obviously are concerned with this new proclamation issued by the so-called national government of Iranian Azerbaijan. Late reports say this government has issued a 19-point program to inform the world that the new group will act on democratic principles without violating the integrity of Iran. The situation in Azerbaijan, to say the least, is confused. And one point that should be clarified, and clarified immediately, is the part Russian troops played in setting up this new government. One report reaching London today blames Red Army forces for the surrender of the Persian general in Tabriz. The Red Army, so goes the report, kept the Persian troops in their garrison, even removed their sidearms, while the Democrats occupied nearby buildings. Back here in London, today is the day the House of Lords opens debate on the dollar loan and the Bretton Woods monetary plan. Misgivings expressed during last week's Commons debate will be repeated again. But while Lord Beaverbrook is demanding that the House of Lords reject the government motion, if this were done, it would raise such a grave constitutional issue that most observers believe the peers will balk and then not bite. And down at Church House, Committee 8 of the United Nations Preparatory Commission, having agreed to recommend the United States as the home for UNO, is now sorting out the massive data having to do with the exact location. The two latest American cities to put in bids are Cincinnati and St. Louis. This is Ed Hawker in London, switching you to NBC in Washington.
And this is Leif Eade in Washington, where it's colder than a landlord's greeting to Chester Bowles, the OPA man. And all through the House, the pros and the antis on the United Nations question are busy grinding their battle axes for the discussion on how best this country can help keep world peace. This time, the question is about how far this country's representative on the Security Council can go in ordering our troops and warships into action to back up the Council's decisions on keeping peace by force. The Senate's already given the President's representative full power. But President Truman, unlike the late Franklin Roosevelt, always has more trouble with the House than with his old friends in the Senate. So the boys in the House may show us some fine legislative tempers before the week's out, and they all go home to enjoy the glad season of Christmas. On the labor front this morning, the President's first fact-finders for the oil industry go to work with the advantage of a settlement in one company, Sinclair. The CIO oil workers compromise their 30% demand for 18%. And so at midnight tonight, the Navy's turning back 11 refineries to Sinclair. The General Motors fact-finders hold their first meeting with company and union men next Wednesday. And there's more than just a hint that their report, when it comes out, and if it comes out, won't be too specific. In fact, they say they'll make a final report only if they think it will hurry the settlement and be in the public interest, which may have something to do with the information they expect to find in the company and the union records. In Detroit this morning, the Kaiser Fraser men are getting ready for this afternoon's first wage confab with the auto workers. And if Henry Kaiser lives up to his record in the past, something quite startling may come out of this conference. Kaiser's always got along very well with unions. But the word is that the new auto company will ask for guarantees against wildcat strikes before it makes any wage offer. This week also may see a wage offer by Ford, and that would have an immediate effect on the General Motors situation. Ford spoke very nicely of the auto workers, his auto workers, last night when he said that since VJ Day, there hasn't been a single wildcat walkout in Ford plants. Otherwise, this morning, Republican Senator Brewster says the Pearl Harbor investigators ought to cut short other evidence to hear General Short and Admiral Kimmel, and says then perhaps we'll be looking elsewhere to place some of the blame. This morning, the Senate takes up that sticky Palestine question. And this morning, CPA man John Small is asking us that as long as lumber and brick are scarce, not to build such things as nightclubs, juke joints, roadside hot dog stands, and other cultural centers. Eade in Washington, returning you now to New York.
American prosecutors in military courts are making final preparations today for the first Japanese war crimes trials, which are scheduled to open in Yokohama tomorrow. For a first-hand account, we switch now to NBC in Tokyo.
Come in, NBC in Tokyo. Come in, NBC in Tokyo. We're sorry, but due to conditions beyond our control, we are unable to bring you this portion of our program. We return you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
And again, this is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York. At Yokohama, 10 American military commissions today set the stage for the first war crimes trials to be held in Japan. 5 Japanese who were accused of committing or condoning atrocities against Allied war prisoners will be the first to be tried. The commission members today emphasized that the accused will be given fair trials. Prince Konoye's suicide yesterday is expected to have serious repercussions both in the imperial household and in political circles. Some Japanese said the suicide might even result in Emperor Hirohito's resignation. There is no doubt that Konoye's death was a blow to the emperor, for the ex-premier was his close confidant, and it is generally believed Hirohito placed great faith in him. In the meantime, American headquarters is believed to be taking steps to ensure that in the future there will be no escape by high-ranking Japanese war crime suspects. The grace period, which has been allowed before their arrest, may be abolished as a result of Konoye's suicide. His arrest had been ordered by General MacArthur December the 6th, and midnight last night was the deadline for his delivery into custody. Some Japanese sources believe he took his life rather than give testimony that might involve Emperor Hirohito. Kanoi and other high-ranking Japanese have admitted that Hirohito had attended key meetings which determined the Pacific War, and therefore he knew as much about the plans as cabinet members. At Chungking today, President Truman's declaration of American policy toward China was received with enthusiastic approval from central government leaders, while communist leaders were skeptical. Both sides, though, are awaiting the arrival of General George C. Marshall for clarification of the president's hopes that China's political turmoil can be settled without recourse to an all-out civil war. General Chu Anlei, the deputy communist leader, today arrived in Chungking with four other delegates to meet with central government officials in peace talks. And a communist spokesman said they welcomed the whole spirit of the Truman statement. In the meantime, a Honolulu dispatch reports that General Marshall left Hawaii for Chungking this morning. He arrived at Hickam Field yesterday morning and spent the day as guest of Lieutenant General Richardson, American Army commander. The International War Crimes Court at Nuremberg today heard evidence showing that German leaders deliberately planned to starve to death tens of millions of Russians or force them into Siberia so that Germans at home could have a larger meat ration. The American prosecution introduced documents revealing that Adolf Hitler had ordered seizure of all Russian livestock after the 1941 invasion. The Nazi plan frankly admitted that many tens of millions of people would become redundant and would either die or have to emigrate to Siberia. Meanwhile, the number of defendants was reduced again, at least temporarily today, to 20 when Ernst Kaltenbrunner was taken from the courtroom complaining of a headache. It was thought he may have suffered another cranial hemorrhage of the same type which hit him just before the trial began. Trial observers said today that virtually all the 21 defendants were losing their nonchalant courtroom attitude and apparently are becoming resigned to death as punishment for their crimes. Well, your World News Roundup today brought you Ed Hocker in London and Leif Eade in Washington. And now, your announcer has this to say.
In many parts of the country, the victory loan drive officially ended on December the 8th. However, all over the country, every bond sold before December 31st will be counted in the victory loan drive total. This gives us all a chance to buy a bond for Christmas. And as we look forward to this first peacetime Christmas in years, surely all of us will want to express our thanks to those who helped make it possible. The best way to do that is by buying victory bonds, by giving them as Christmas presents. Your Christmas gift of victory bonds will help to pay for the care of our wounded, the care of the families of the men who were killed, the cost of bringing our men home, and the cost of rehabilitating veterans as they return to peacetime lives. These are only a few of the reasons for buying victory bonds, for giving victory bonds as Christmas gifts. So this year, give the present with a future. Buy victory bonds for Christmas. Now back to James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York.
Well, sir, you'd better wear your earmuffs and long underwear today if you live between the Atlantic Ocean and the Rocky Mountains. For most of the continent is shivering under frigid temperatures, which are moving southeastward from the Arctic Circle. United States weathermen predict temperatures of 5 to 10 above zero along the coastal area from New York to Norfolk today. Temperatures generally are below normal in a wide area east of the Rockies. It is below zero in East Montana and the Dakotas and eastward through central Illinois and Indiana. The coldest spot in the country seems to be Glasgow, Montana, where it was 20 below at midnight. Freezing temperatures are reported as far south as the northern end of the Florida Peninsula and along the Gulf to southern Mississippi. At Buffalo, schools were ordered closed and the mayor proclaimed a state of emergency. One of the worst blizzards in the city's history has practically paralyzed Buffalo, New York. And that's the World News Roundup for this morning of December the 17th. This is James Stevenson in the NBC Newsroom in New York, and I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.